thank you very much. Let's begin with the Conseil d'État and the my proposal. You see, basically, the thought is that that in the traditional American system, Supreme Court review, the dynamism of the president creating facts on the ground of a dramatically problematic character with the propaganda and all this just didn't exist, so that we could afford, and there are many advantages in waiting for a couple of years and then coming and reaching a particular decision, oftentimes after the heat of passion has calmed down a little bit, and things of this kind. The basic question is, given the construction of this new machine, do we want another break, a legalistic break in the machine? Notice, there's already in this institution of executive constitutionalism, in the White House counsel and the Office of Legal Counsel, the law is already being invoked as a key legitimating device for presidential aggrandizement. As in, you know, the most notorious case is the torture memo, but there are many cases of this. So, when I say Supreme Executive Tribunal, I do not mean Supreme Tribunal. I mean, as Olivier was pointing out, a new institution that will propound the law for the executive branch, and which could control and constrain the executive branch and limit the most egregious and eliminate in the first phase some, maybe not all, of the most egregious examples of presidential decree power and unilateralism, so that we don't have to wait 2 years for the Supreme Court to tell us maybe, maybe yes. But so at the present time, the Office of Legal Counsel, the actual statutory basis of this is very unclear, but at the present time, the Office of Legal Counsel is conceded the authority to state the law for the executive branch. So there is already a Supreme Executive Tribunal, let's say, except, of course, they don't think of themselves as a tribunal. They don't hear arguments on both sides. They think of themselves as counsel to the president. And that's, of course, a position of an advocate, doubtless a responsible advocate, but still an advocate rather than a judge. So, and it's that invocation of the Conseil d'État, obviously, it's a remote analogy. I mean, I'm not at all suggesting that this tribunal would operate like the Conseil d'État. It's just that we have in the Conseil tradition, and it's not only France, after all, it's Italy and other places, a notion of a rule of law institution in the executive branch, which is pre-screening executive actions. And it works sometimes. It doesn't work perfect. We all know it's an institution. It works the way institutions work. Sometimes it makes bad mistakes, all this. But it's that check, anterior check that I'm speaking of. I do want to mention one of the reforms that Olivier mentioned and then stopped, because we can have more chance to talk afterwards, Olivier. Because I think this reform is a good idea for France. Even better idea for France than the United States, and it has to do with this National Endowment for Journalism. Basically, journalism is being destroyed. The economic basis of journalism is, meaning serious journalists who have long-time contacts with a set of problems, can write in a relatively dispassionate way, in ways that readers, human beings, can read rather than academics writing, you know, to fellow academics. This is obviously a central function of democracy, especially given the rise of the media manipulation. And so at the same time we see the rise of media manipulation, we see the destruction of the economic foundations of newspapers. Why is this more important in France than in the United States? Because in the English-speaking zone, there are enough, if you forgive the expression, English-speaking eyeballs, that you can actually have two or three serious newspapers in the whole English-speaking world. New York Times, Washington Post, The Guardian, that can finance its serious reporting with simply revenue from people looking at the advertisements. But when we go to smaller language zones like France or Germany, there just are not enough eyeballs. Then, of course, we go to, you know, Czech Republic or, you know. So the destruction of the old model really is devastating to enlightenment democracy. I mean, that's really, you know, I'm a liberal Republican is what I am. You know, I mean, not in the American sense, but in the sort of, you know. What is the solution? Because this is, you know, I'm also sort of a crazed Jeremy Bentham, you know, doing little solutions. This is a solution. At the end of, when you read a newspaper article on the internet, there is a question at the bottom of each article. Says, does this article contribute to your understanding as a citizen? You can vote yes, but in order to do so, you have to waste 20 seconds of your time writing in little codes to convince the system that you're not a computer, but a person. So that wastes 20 seconds. So you're not going to do it every time. You punch it, and it goes to the National Endowment for Journalism, which each year gets an appropriation from the state. The money is appropriated on the basis of the votes. An algorithm, you know, let's say you have 400 million euros a year, I don't know, some number like that. And every time you say yes, you know, that the originator of that article gets 2 centimes or whatever. In order to register as a recipient from the endowment, you have to have an insurance policy for libel. So that means just bloggers cannot get money. You have to have an institution with an editorial function. So a reporter comes to you and says something which is false. The editor says, no, you cannot publish this because it's false, and the libel insurance people are going to get angry at us. So in order to get to be a recipient, you have to convince the insurance companies that you have a control function. So we have then a system like that of modernity, in which is like a market, in that it's responsive to people's opinions about what's interesting. You see, it isn't a state monopoly. I'm all for the BBC as one institution, but obviously, in a presidentialist system, which is French as well as American, whatever differences, and we could talk about that, you don't want the President of the Republic, a la, you know, Berlusconi controlling all the media. So we have this market-like mechanism, except that it isn't you paying, it's your citizen concern motivating wasting 20 seconds of your time and rewarding Le Monde or some radical journal or whatever on the basis of how interesting it is. Once again, my emphasis is always on these structures rather than, you know, there are obviously some of the money is going to go to garbage. But freedom of speech, obviously you can't censor the articles or anything like that. But in any event, I propose this as one response to the rise of media manipulation, but I do think it's a very general significance, especially outside the English-speaking world. It's a great loss. I mean, I sometimes write op-eds for the Los Angeles Times. The Los Angeles Times newsroom has, I don't take these numbers seriously, but they are basically on the right track, 1,100 people in the newsroom down to 450 in the last 5 years. Well, you know, just the last 5 years. It is no longer a great newspaper. It used to be. So, you know, you have Le Monde in obvious financial trouble. Figaro, you know, you have quite a few newspapers, not enough eyeballs. So the next 5 years are going to be really tough for reporting, and it's a, I don't have to go on, you know, this is an obvious loss. And there is this kind of solution which, you know, we've tested it out. I've developed this with my friend Ian Ayers, who is a very brilliant kind of techno person at the Yale Law School. And there are many technical problems. There's technical solutions. And there is a need. Of course, it costs something, but not very much, as, you know, as expenditures go, given the fundamental threat to Enlightenment values that the destruction of journalism poses to us. So I did want to, I mean, thank you for pointing that out, but I did want to emphasize it because this is, you know, my aims in these proposals are, of course, to respond to the problem that I developed, but obviously many of the phenomena, not the military, I think the military is special to the United States right now, but many of the kinds of phenomena that I'm pointing to have analogs in one, to one degree or another, in other constitutional systems. But this one is universal. I mean, every newspaper, every journalism is simply threatened throughout the world, and more threatened the fewer people who are reading that language.
Bruce, yes. Before taking some questions, do you want to answer also the one with the, concerning the Congress?
Yes, I think that's a very important one. There are two ways of viewing the Congress. I basically think the Congress is not such a bad institution. I think that it's appropriate that every president of the United States, really since Franklin Roosevelt for sure, claims a mandate from the people to do large things. That's part of the legitimating mode of discussion. This concept of the mandate is very large in life, although in constitutional theory in the United States, not so. How do we know whether President Obama has a mandate? Well, does he win the next election? If he had won this election, then people say, hey, you know, maybe the American people are giving him a mandate. Because presidents always claim a mandate, even when it's just nothing. So I basically believe that the standard American, I'm a partisan, but we forget about the partisanship, the way of reading this last election is Obama claimed a mandate to transform the system. American people aren't buying it right now. Too bad. But that's what we see. That's the genius of the system of checks and balances. I think it's a great loss when, in your system, you made the 5-year presidency and then put the parliament right afterwards so that you don't have a test of the presidential mandate as you had in the 7-year system and you had cohabitation. I think cohabitation actually was an institution that worked. Again, you know, as institutions work, rather than... I think this way of giving the president a check in the middle is important because sometimes we give it and sometimes we don't. But there's the other alternative interpretation, which is the presidentialist one. We have a crisis of governability. Here are these pressing problems. We have these Republicans or Democrats right now, you know, these Republicans, they aren't interested in public good. they're just interested in destroying Obama. Of course they're just in destroying Obama. They're the opposition. What is this? This is not new. They're interested in the public good because they think Obama is inconsistent with the public good. They might be wrong. That's a different question. But to, you know, but they are, it's a crisis. We have to act unilaterally. Who can do it? The President of the United States. This is what Bill Clinton did time and again after 1995 when he lost control of Congress. Elena Kagan's article, which is a wonderful article in the Harvard Law Review called Presidential Administration, is about this use of the power that she helped engineer in the White House to give directives. Bill Clinton goes into the press room and says, the EPA, well, Obama, my prediction, Obama goes into the press room and says, we're going to get tough on polluters. Congress, we have a crisis of governability. We have to be tough on global warming. I'm going to direct the Environmental Protection Agency to have a whole new initiative under a statute which was never designed for global warming, on global warming, and many people will say, great. I'll say great in my substantive part, not my constitutional part, because he's preparing the way for Sarah Palin. Or someone else, you know, I don't want to scare you with Sarah Palin, maybe it'll be someone else, you know, in 10 years, I don't care. Congress, of course, there should be reforms, you know, but I don't, the reason why I didn't try to be comprehensive in this book is because I really do want to focus on what I think is the danger, which is this presidential excess. And I didn't want to divert too much attention to reforms. And of course, the other problem with reforms on Congress is that you have to change the text of the Constitution, which is something that's very difficult to do, put it mildly, on anything that's controversial. So let's say an obvious reform would be to give California, to organize it like the Bundesrat in Germany. So, you know, you have a federal system in the Bundesrat, but populated Länder have 9 votes, or I don't know what the top is, and the small ones have 2. That's obviously what, it's just ridiculous to have California, which is 38 million people or something like that, have 2 senators, and Nevada, or what's the smallest population, what's the smallest population? Smallest state.
Rhode Island.
Well, you know, some state which doesn't have 1 million people have 2 senators. Come on. This is ridiculous. That kind of thing. But I didn't want to divert attention, first of all, because it is the presidency is the real problem. And second, it's impossible to change that, except without 3/4 of the states, among them being Rhode Island, have to approve. So it's that reason, those 2 reasons, Olivier, that I didn't emphasize.
Thank you so much. I have already 1 question, please.
Yeah,
je
suis d'accord avec Sciences Po. And I very much enjoyed your talk and the very challenging and the broad historical survey that you traced of the advice of the presidency. And of course, that was surprising for us when you pointed the image of this dangerous, extreme charismatic president that could emerge in the future and described Bush's son as a moderate president. For Europeans, he was not perceived as a moderate. I mean, for us, he's more the example of the president. But you made the wonderful distinction between the old convention way of selecting the president as opposed to the generalization of the primary system after 72. And the question then is, has to do with history. Aren't you expressing maybe too much of a nostalgia? And of course, I don't know anything about the remedies.
Please.
I mean,
yes.
For the old system, that is to say, an old system which, in fact, did produce extremist candidates. Think of Goldwater. I mean, he was not elected, but
right.
In many ways, he was an extremist candidate.
Yes, yes.
And an old system which also, particularly during the time of the Cold War, produced both the presidency and the military are a tremendous propaganda machine at the time of the Cold War, and that's well illustrated in William in Barton's book recently about the Cold War presidents and the manipulation of religion for political purpose. So why is the new system that you described that different from the old one? And why should we be more worried today than we were in the 60s or in the 50s? Yes.
Well, first, I should say that it's easy from the talk to suppose that I'm looking back with nostalgia in general, and that is not my intention. That is to say, I think that the you know, the idea, for example, of eliminating the president's staff is silly in an activist regulatory state, which didn't exist in America before the New Deal, and in an imperial hegemon in which the president has to have capacity to evaluate military advice and all of these things. So you're quite right. And indeed, my own what I say about the primaries on the reform side is, you know, they're here to stay. I do not advocate their revision. What is the Constitution? The Constitution is the foundations of a structure of public intelligibility. It's the language within which Americans talk, the grammar of legitimacy. At the present moment, primaries are a foundational element in the American system precisely because people look back with distaste on the old boss-ridden system. My only point is, there's a downside to the present constitutional arrangement, the increase in the probability of extremist demagogues. Sarah Palin is not Goldwater. Goldwater is a senior, experienced senator of the United States who is basically a person who is expressing domestically classical liberal, what you in France would call classical liberal values of free markets. And he is a cold warrior, just like everybody else, just like John F. Kennedy, just like everybody else. I quite agree that I would not have voted for Barry Goldwater, that he was an extremist. He was a right-wing candidate. But he is a seasoned and genuinely thoughtful person. This is not true of, from what we knew of Barack Obama, he could have been Sarah Palin. He's untested. He comes to Washington 2 years. You know, of course, he's a graduate of the Harvard Law School, et cetera, and so forth. That's important both to him personally, but is a good test, but that's not really the kind of test. That's even worse than the old convention test. It's a happy accident that he is who he is. But I quite agree with you that I do not want to... I don't think that it would destroy the legitimacy of the system to Americans say you can't have primaries. But that only makes the other parts of the reform more important because we're not going to eliminate the risk of a demagogic president. I think that look at Sarkozy and people like this. There's going to be in any presidentialist system a risk of a demagogic president, but. And ours has that risk, that's what I'm saying. And therefore, on these other fronts, like the Supreme Executive Tribunal or other things like that, we should build those up. That, sir. Oui, and I can probably understand it.
Parfaitement français. Oui.
Yeah. Well, he and I were law clerks to a judge in our youth, same judge in our youth, and we saw each other recently.
Yeah, amazing man.
Yeah.
I have two questions that are linked, so let me get them both out there.
Sure.
One is, and I'm sure you've heard this and anticipated it, but doesn't the notion of presidential excess feel funny today when we have a president elected with a decent majority, two houses, and all we can point to in terms of accomplishments are legislative ones, namely you get to use a huge amount of political capital to get health reform through compromise routine. And meanwhile, he's not even doing a very good job of day-to-day governing because he can't get his appointments confirmed in the U.S. attorneys and the judges and throughout justice. So is this only because he's not charismatic? Is my question. And then linked to this, Bruce, is not a big problem, in fact, even a bigger problem. What I think of is the privatization of political influence. And I'm really, to me, we're only beginning to see the impact of this amazing decision of the Supreme Court in Citizens United, which authorizes and indeed protects private money in huge amounts to flow through the system and have an impact on primaries and have an impact on appointments of primaries. And it seems to me, isn't that as big an engine as anything else that's going to lead to the kind of scary story we're talking about?
Well, of course, when the president controls Congress, or thinks his party controls Congress, the chances of the unilateral imperative diminishes, and so the basic problems that I described reach their peak. When in the very standard situation in the last 50 or 60 years, where the president is of one party and the Congress is of the other party, and the Congress therefore is resisting and the president is pushing, so one low level thing is I predict that you will see a lot more unilateral action by President Obama starting January 3rd. And on appointments, I predict you will see an abuse of the resource appointment mechanism, which permits presidents to appoint people now for 2 years unilaterally to the end of his term. So we're going to see this phenomena. I also believe, that's too far down. Then, is campaign finance a problem? Yes, it's definitely a problem. And you'll be shocked to learn I've written a book on how to reform the campaign finance system, and it's sort of like the internet voucher. Every registered voter gets a, when he goes to the polls, he puts his credit card through a reader. And in America, if you are poor, you, in order to get food stamps, which is the safety net provision of food, you get an electronic card. You put that card through a reader, and it opens up an account of 50 democracy dollars. And you can go to any bank machine or computer and then send your 50 democracy dollars to any candidate, a party, or interest group, which then would be a broker for things, of your choice. That's one. I wrote this book with Ian Ayers. The other one is the secret donation booth. You still can give green dollars. We call the first one red, white, and blue dollars. Thank you. once is something, tragedy, the second one, whatever. I forget what Marx said, you know. The second is a crime. The second idea is this. I can go up to Sarkozy and say, I think you're great. I'm going to give you €100,000 for your re-election campaign. The only legal way to give Sarkozy money is through what we in American, Anglo-American law call a blind trust. What's the equivalent in French law? I'm not sure. It's an account, a bank account, which is anonymous. The donors are anonymous. So Sarkozy, I go up to him and say, I'll give you $100,000. You go up to him, I'll give you $200,000. At the end of the week, Sarkozy loses his bank account, €6,000. that is to say, because we break the link, rather than have full information about who gives, we break the link so that Sarkozy can't know who is giving. Everyone, knowing this, will go up to Sarkozy and say, I've given you a lot. It's like going into a Mercedes dealer and saying, I'm going to buy a super Mercedes, and I'm going to give you 150,000 euros into your anonymous bank account. You know, this would eliminate the sale of automobiles very quickly. If you put these two reforms together, you would have... You see, I reject the idea that there's too much money in politics. It's the distribution that's wrong. There are many people in France who go through the election campaign, don't hear anything about anything. To think that we should cut back on the amount of money in politics so that there'll be more ignorant voters is not so good. It's rather the distribution of money that is the problem. So if you put these two together, there are 140 million voters in America, so that would be $7 billion in... And if that many people also voted with their dollars, that would be $7 billion that would finance the campaign. And then maybe $1 billion or so would be for people who actually believed in the candidate enough so that he would give him money even though the candidate can't check it out. So I do agree with you. It's just that, you know, this book isn't supposed to just be a review of Bruce Ackerman's solutions to everything. I wanted to have some new ones. But I agree with you that this is a very serious problem, and the Supreme Court has made it much worse in its silly idea that money is the same thing as freedom of expression.
Thank you, Bruce. Professor Barange.
Taking for granted that the president is the only executive officer of the constitution, I'm taking for granted that impeachment was supposed to be the check to his abuse of power. My question would be, is impeachment still the right device as far as executive accountability is concerned? Shouldn't we extend personal accountability to people who are unknown to the Constitution, like all the penumbra of presidential advisors that is growing, as you said? Shouldn't there be new tools to put those people to account in a way that they aren't today?
Yes, I agree. One of my reforms is just this, but I do believe that impeachment, given... Now, I should tell you, I just want to discount for partisanship. I was... on Bill Clinton's team in the impeachment controversy and was his first witness before the House Judiciary Committee. So obviously I'm a bias, but I think that impeachment as a tool has been discredited for the next period by this very silly use of the impeachment weapon. But I very much agree with you that we should hold the Larry Summers and the... at the present time, the Senate must confirm, absolutely, constitutionally required to confirm the ambassador to Luxembourg. The Senate does not confirm the National Security Advisor. So, I have a proposal in my, I call it a grand bargain. On the one hand, as you were just pointing out, the senators stall appointments for petty political reasons. They want to have they want to have an extension of the airport in their district. So they say, I'm not going to confirm the Secretary of Defense. Worse yet, I'm going to filibuster. You know, time is precious, you can't do this. So there's this abuse, and then there is a countervailing abuse, which is that the Senate, while being very much a stickler for the Deputy Assistant Secretary, which is confirmable, doesn't confirm the National Security Advisor. So, say I, let's have a grand bargain. The Senate agrees up and down votes after 60 days on appointments, that they can no longer, for petty reasons, stall forever. Or a year sometimes, 15 months or so, And in return, the White House agrees that the Senate should also confirm the top stratum of the White House staff, Larry Summers, the White House counsel, and the like. And so that would restore the check of the Senate on these fundamental offices, and at the same time, not lead to the kind of slipshod undermining of an executive administration, which, as you were saying, is a real problem. So, and this one may have a little bit of, I mean, I have quite a few suggestions. This one I could actually see realistic scenarios permitting this to occur. Of course, if once the office becomes confirmable, then the officer, the National Security Advisor, has more leverage. If he says, I'm going to resign, then the president has to go and get another one confirmed. At the present time, if the White House counsel says, this is illegal, you're fired, then I appoint somebody else. And there is, of course, 2 days in the newspapers, but I have actually filled the office. So I quite agree with you that although impeachment is not going to be in the feasible set, except in very, very extreme cases, that we need to control the White House staff. Thank you for a little louder.
So I have a question on what you called the politicization of the military, the militarization of politics. General Petraeus was in Paris yesterday.
Yes.
To make a speech on the international engagement in Afghanistan.
I know, yeah.
And he obviously played a huge important role both in Iraq and in Afghanistan right now. And so I'm just wondering, have your thoughts on to what extent has General Petraeus enhanced the militarization of politics or the politicization of the military in Afghanistan? And he plays both roles.
Well, we have let me put it in French terms. You see, what we have is, I said the Yale Law School is an ENA, but the difference between ENA and the Yale Law School is this. I train people, and they serve 2 years in the government, then they go into the private sector, and then they go back into the government when their party is in power. ENA, they serve the government for 30 years. Or more or less. That's the norm, at least. Oh, no more. Well, 8 years. But in any event, that's bad, if it's true. While we have an ENA for the military, it's called West Point. It's called the Naval Academy and the Air Force Academy. So we have an asymmetric civil service. A politicized, on the civilian side, very able people moving in and out, and as their party follows. But on the military side, we have something that looks pretty French. People coming up, and they are colonizing more and more offices of a civilian kind. That's the first. General Petraeus has played a central political role, both for George Bush. Critically, I just want to tick off all of the examples of the politicization of the military. The first thing that you were the reason I gave you the other fact is this is the militarization of political appointments. Not General Petraeus, necessarily, but more and more people who have military careers are taking offices that were in theory civilian. They retire and then they take the office at the age of 60, let's say. On General Petraeus, Bush is repudiated in the 2006 election. The Democrats come in. They are saying, out of Iraq. Bush says, let's escalate. Forget, once again, the substantive wisdom of the surge and all of it. he's going to have a tough time. He brings General Petraeus to Washington, D.C., and General Petraeus gives a speech to the House Armed Services Committee on September 11th, 2007. Saying it's, or maybe it's 2006, I'm not quite sure which year, either quite just before or right after the election, saying we need a surge. There. I mean, this is just the ex, you know, here Bush has been weakened. It's very funny because Bush's lawyers are big on the theory of the unitary executive and how the president is, you know, the sovereign and all of this. And then he brings Petraeus in at his moment of need. And he was very important there. And then Barack Obama is now using him again to legitimate a strategy which, you know, I think is deeply misconceived, but that's neither here nor there. But his party base, of which I'm an extremist from within my model, I'm a left guy. From his party base, his continuing of the Afghan war to 2014 is a terrible blunder. So he's bringing General Petraeus in there to, you know, calm us down and pacify the center. So this is very much a will General Petraeus run for president one day? Quite possible.
Another question.
Armel Divelec Paris 2. Je vais parler français parce que c'est grave. Plus
if I have
moi.
A trouble, I mean, I basically know my thesis, as I was remarking in college, was on Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and not everything by Rousseau was translated at the time. I could read French and.
Je vais parler avec l'accent suisse. Oui, oui. je trouve très passionnant tous les thèmes que vous abordez. C'est vraiment un très grand plaisir de vous écouter. Il y aurait beaucoup de choses qu'on a envie de discuter. J'ai une remarque et puis une observation-question. La remarque, c'est que souvent, en Europe, on considère que les systèmes de gouvernement parlementaire, lorsqu'ils sont stables, ne produisent plus de contrôle véritable par les parlements, parce que les parlements soutiennent l'exécutif et que le contrôle de l'opposition est faible. On regarde souvent avec envie vers les États-Unis en se disant, là, on a un véritable système de checks and balances et c'est une chose qui peut-être plus modère plus le pouvoir, mieux le pouvoir que dans les régimes parlementaires européens, qui sont des régimes souvent à exécutif fort, dans les grands pays. Et ce que vous dites tend à relativiser cette idée, ça je trouve ça intéressant pour les Français ou les Européens, ça nous montre qu'au fond, aucun des deux grands modèles de gouvernement ne produit naturellement, à l'époque moderne, sa propre modération, et donc que ces checks and balances doivent toujours être réinventés dans chacun des systèmes. Donc ça relativisera peut-être beaucoup de les Français qui regardent avec envie vers le modèle américain. Et alors plus spécifiquement, je voudrais revenir sur un des points très intéressants que vous avez soulevé, sur les conseillers présidentiels, au fond qui ne sont plus les secretaries, mais les conseillers privés qui ne sont pas confirmés par le Sénat. Je me demande tout de même si ça n'est pas dans la logique du système de gouvernement présidentiel tel qu'il n'a peut-être pas été conçu par les pères de Philadelphie, mais qui s'est formé dans les décennies qui ont suivi, quand, après Washington, on a vu qu'il n'y avait pas de cabinet. Et vous avez parlé de cabinet, ce qui m'a étonné, parce qu'il me semblait que, au fond, tel qu'en tout cas les Français, je crois, le comprennent, des auteurs américains, ont considéré qu'il n'y a pas de véritable cabinet aux États-Unis. Donc, est-ce que cette évolution est si illogique? Est-ce qu'elle n'était pas dans la logique même du système? Et à supposer que les présidents américains, maintenant, ne transforment pas leurs véritables conseillers dans des conseillers privés plutôt que les secrétaires officiels qui pourraient faire l'objet d'un impeachment ou bien qui doivent d'abord être confirmés par le Sénat, est-ce que ça change véritablement les choses? Et est-ce que l'idée que l'influence que pourrait retrouver le Sénat en confirmant les véritables conseillers, est-ce que ce n'est pas trop tôt? Et quid, que devient un contrôle a posteriori? Car au fond, le Sénat ne fait pas toujours un contrôle très politique de ses conseillers. Donc est-ce que ça n'est pas finalement un problème qui ne comporte pas de solution facile telle que vous le
présentez? Well, first of all, I'm happy to report I understood. I understood everything you said. On the first fundamental remark, where I wrote a very long article in the Harvard Law Review called "The New Separation of Powers," which is one of these articles. Despite the fact that it's in the Harvard Law Review, nobody reads it in America. But it's been translated quite. I don't think it's been translated into French, but it's actually one of my more influential ones outside of America. And the basic thesis is this: that we actually have three models of constitutionalism in the world today, in the Western world. We have the Montesquieu model, Americanized. Of course, Montesquieu had no idea of any of this, but nonetheless, Americanized. Then we have the House of Commons Fourth Republic model of parliamentary government. Then coming out of Germany after the Second World War, we have a model that I call constrained parliamentarianism, in which there is no president. The Americans, you know, everybody should copy them, but somehow they had the idea that maybe a president of Germany would open the way up for another Adolf Hitler. Let's not do that. Let's have a parliamentary government. And with a voting system which promotes several parties. I think their threshold is too low, but let's say the threshold for a party is 15% rather than 5%. Anyway, so we have the parliament, and then we have the constitutional court, which is a non-elected institution which constrains the elected institution. Now, I argue in this, it's 140 pages, so I don't know whether it's an article, but nonetheless, it's this article, that this model should be ceteris paribus, which, of course, you know, every country has its institutional histories and things like that, should be the model for development in the 21st century. Because it, but we should have more checks than merely the constitutional court. For example, if we look around the country, the world, without Montesquieu telling us that there are three branches and things, and ask which branches of government are insulated from the majority, from the parliament. As an empirical matter, there are at least two. One is the Electoral Commission. France, well, you have it in the Conseil Constitutionnel a little bit, but let's take India, a great puzzle for constitutionalists. That is, you name a political science condition for constitutional democracy, India does not have it. And yet it works. They don't have a common language, they have this huge division of classes and castes. It's terrible, it's a huge country. How does the system work? Well, I think this is a fascinating issue for constitutionalists. But it's corrupt, the bureaucracy is corrupt. they have an election commission that has constitutional status, which is insulated in dramatic ways, which I won't detail. The head of the commission is has the status of the Chief Justice. They have 750, maybe more, smart technocrats who get paid huge salaries, which they lose their pensions if they are found to be crooked. And in fact, one thing you can say more or less about Indian democracy is they count the votes accurately. In a world in which, if you want to have a driver's license, you have to pay someone 20 rupees. Election commissions is a separate branch. And that helps you. So how should we think about which branches should be insulated? That's the fundamental question. And one is, okay, what are the foundational values of the Republic? And there could be different ones. And then, do we have a behavioral model to say that this is going to be very, very delicate if we give it to the Parliament? So the fundamental value here is easy, democracy, in the primitive sense of counting the votes. And we have a very simple model of political action that the sitting politicians will want to cheat. So therefore, we should have a separate power. Another one, much more vulnerable, which certainly exists from the descriptive point of view, is the central bank. 50 years ago, central banks were not independent. Only the Federal Reserve Board. Central banks have swept, independent central banks have swept the world. Okay, so what is the philosophy? Neoliberalism, that's a different philosophy. In which you don't want the politicians to fool with the money supply. So that's the value, and that's the institutional pathology. Is that an appropriate constitutional value? Well, you know, you reasonably can, that's a much harder case for separation than electoral commissions. I myself argue for a redistributional branch as taking 15% of the national budget and having a set system of redistributional priorities, which is should be independent. One of Marx's great mistakes was he thought that the workers and peasants would take power and then keep power. Well, they don't take power very often, and they certainly don't keep power at all. But if you think, as I do, that the market system systematically generates injustice, economic injustice, well, that would be a reason for having a separate power. But once again, like neoliberalism, this is a much more controversial matter than the first one. So my basic response to your remark is that really we see a third way that's analytically different from the modernized Montesquieuisms of the American, Latin American, Philippine system, and the third, fourth French Republic and classic British House of Commons system of the 20th century, and that this way, coming out of Germany, then Spain, we have, you know, France comes in its own way, you know, should be the model of the future as a first approximation. Obviously, if I said in the United States, let's have a system of constrained parliamentarianism, they would say, what are you talking about, Bruce? You've been, you know, this is... our system works. I mean, you know, you have to relativize this to a historical development of things. I think I better not. I'll answer your other question after, but afterwards. So,
thank you so much. I think that we were supposed to end at 2:30.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We are over.
I'm sorry.
Still,
I was having
two
this
questions.
Feeling.
Maybe that's so small one.
Yes, please.
And Lorraine Bujon, and then Professor.
And then I'll talk
if
to you
want,
afterwards.
If you don't want.
If we don't have more, like,
go ahead. Go ahead.
I can make it a very small question, but I'm afraid your answer might not be.
Okay,
so
don't
if
worry.
You don't want to take the question.
No, take the question. Take the question. Give me the
question.
And I'll answer afterwards if I can.
It's maybe naive, but how feasible is it to reform American institutions or the Constitution? In short term, for President Obama, touching the institutional system now would amount to political suicide, wouldn't it? I mean, with this talk that he's not legitimate and not American. Okay.
And the second.
Long term, when have there been successful institutional changes and what were the driving forces?
All of the things that I've been describing are successful institutional changes. President Obama, you point out to him, well, you know, maybe. The next president after you is going to be a Republican, and you know the Supreme Executive Tribunal will give you a lot of power. You're going to appoint all 9 judges. My the details of my formulation is of each president appoints 3 judges during his term, and they have 12-year term in office. So there's a rolling 12 years. If the first person not only will get historic recognition for this great achievement, but also will be able to constrain to some extent the unilateral power of a successor. So maybe that might make sense in the second Obama term. Similarly, there are some things like the endowment for journalism that I think there are many interests. I think that's a great idea, and Obama would see that's a good idea too on the merits. So we have to look at each and every one of them, and the politics of them is different. But America, you know, there is this form of the Constitution of 1787, which is has various elements hardwired in, saying we should move from 2 to 7 senators from California. That's a problem, but in fact, the living Constitution is one of constant institutional adaptation. We would not be living under the Constitution of 1789 if we weren't constantly innovating. Because this old system, obviously, is not intended to govern a world empire.
Thank you so much. Olivier, do you want to have a few words?
Je vais parler en français pour montrer que je parle mieux français qu'anglais. Remercier toutes les personnes qui ont bien voulu venir. Pour remercier évidemment d'abord et avant tout Bruce Ackerman pour cette très belle conférence, pour son livre. Remercier le président qui nous a permis.
It was genuinely I enjoyed.
Thank you so much. Some cheese to